The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. During the Trump administration, the culture war as we know it has gone from a war of words to an openly violent clash, with attacks taking place at protests in Portland, New York, and many other places. It seemed to start in Charlottesville 3 years ago, where a woman was murdered in a car attack by a right-wing protester. That Charlottesville rally, attended by neo-Nazis as well as pro-Confederates, was held in support of a statue of General Robert E. Lee. So a war that ended 150 years ago, remembered by monuments that went up 100 years ago, is now a flashpoint in a bitter partisan divide. Our staff writer Casey Sepp grew up in the shadow of one of those Confederate monuments, and she has this story about its fate. Here's Casey Sepp.
I grew up in a tiny town in Talbot County on the eastern shore of Maryland. Was like a lot of the towns around here, little farming, little fishing communities, places that have a post office and a few churches and not really much else. So for me growing up, the big city was actually Easton, the county seat. There's a movie theater, grocery stores, a bookstore. There was even a pet shop. I really liked to go and see the parrot there. Easton, if you were to look at it, is really a picture postcard of a colonial town. It's got brick sidewalks, old-timey street lamps. And right in the center of town is a courthouse. If you came up Dover Street or you walked down Washington Street, you'd arrive right at the courthouse. And you'd be standing on this little patch of green grass, looking at this cozy sort of red brick building that has a clock tower, beautiful cupola on top that chimes the time. And if you look to your left, you would see a statue of a boy holding a flag.
So we're looking at a statue of a young boy. Looks like maybe could be 14 years old.
And you see him sort of staring off at the distant horizon. He's got a very proud posture, and he's holding a flag that the wind has kind of got wrapped around him like a cape.
You'd probably assume it was the American flag.
I walked all the way around it trying to get a better look. And it looks actually like that might be a Confederate flag.
Down below him on a giant granite pedestal, bright as day on the front of it, it says, "To the Talbot Boys."
To the Talbot Boys, 1861 to 1865, CSA.
And the date is 1861 to 1865, Confederate States of America. And there's a bunch of names in the side here.
And on the side of the monument, there is a lot of names inscribed. Looks like soldiers, probably, at least at the top. We've got admirals and brigadier generals.
I guess, did Maryland have soldiers fighting on both sides of the Civil War? Is that why?
It actually never seemed odd to me to have a Confederate statue in town. Kids wore Confederate flag t-shirts to school. You would see Confederate flags on people's bumper stickers and on their baseball caps. Maryland might be right square in the mid-Atlantic, but the Eastern Shore has always seen itself as Southern. But now our statue is the last one in the state of Maryland, outside of a battlefield or a graveyard. Mississippi has gotten rid of its Confederate flag. Even Richmond is getting rid of its Confederate monuments. And I sometimes worry we might end up the last town in America that still has a monument to the Confederacy. For 5 years now, a lot of people in Talbot County have been trying to get the statue removed. To be clear, I'm among them. And this summer, the question about what to do with the Talbot boys was finally back on the official agenda.
Resolution 290, Madam Secretary, would you please read the title of the resolution?
Resolution number 290, a resolution prohibiting statues depicting persons, signs, or symbols associated with military action on Talbot County property and providing for the removal of the Talbot Boys statue while retaining the base of the monument.
The Talbot County government is run by a council of 5 members. There are 3 local business people, there's a former parole agent, and a local historian.
I am looking to historical sources to inform some of the discussion around this. Because as a historian, if I'm going to speak credibly about how this monument came to be the way it is, I've got to do my homework.
That's Pete Lesher. Along with serving on the council, he's also a curator at the Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum. Pete comes from a very old Talbot County family, old enough that some of them show up on a certain local monument.
There are Goldsboros and Tillmans, mm-hmm. Cousins of mine, probably others if I really do some digging, who are named on that monument.
One of his ancestors, Oswald Tillman, was part of the group that erected the monument on the courthouse lawn.
Oswald Tillman goes off and fights for the South, comes back to Easton after the war, and he is one of those who helps to raise funds, probably contributes to the Talbot Boys Monument, was on the committee with Joseph B. Seth, who I think was sort of the chairman of that whole effort.
Joseph Seth was a very big guy in Easton around the turn of the 20th century. He was actually behind a lot of things in Easton. He brought the railroad lines to town, he ran the Bar Association, he even raised money to build the hospital that I was born in. And in 1912, he dreamed up the idea of this local monument to the Confederacy. Why just the Confederacy? Well, Joseph Seth came from a slave-owning family, and it's clear from his memoirs that he took a pretty rosy view of slavery.
Slaves were held here from the early days of the colony until the Emancipation Act, but they lived under a paternal, kindly rule. The bulk of the slaves were devoted to their masters and their families, taking great interest in everything concerning them. They considered themselves a part of the family, and their devotion was so great that they would run any risk to protect them.
When you look at the county as a whole, Talbot County was not a pro-secessionist. Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, there were certainly some strong sentiments on both sides. And we saw some people go over the lines and fight in Maryland units that got organized into the Confederate Army.
There was actually originally some talk about a separate Union monument, but it never happened. So Seth and some other Confederate sympathizers just put theirs up. The early 20th century was when this romantic, lost cause narrative of the Confederacy became popular all over the country. A cottage industry sprung up to provide these kinds of statues. The Talbot Boys actually came from a company in Ohio, which had a whole catalog of statues. Actually, the exact same statue stood in Lake Charles, Louisiana, until it was knocked over last month by Hurricane Laura. So in 1916, the Talbot Boys Monument was dedicated on the courthouse lawn. For more than 100 years now, it's had pride of place. You literally have to look up to it. It leaves you feeling like the whole county identifies with the Confederacy, which was never true. I don't think it's a coincidence that 3 years after the statue went up, in 1919, a mob of some 2,000 people tried to lynch a black man on the courthouse grounds.
I get how this pains some people, how you get that knot in your stomach as you walk by the symbol, and how this is a racist symbol. This is a painful reminder of both Talbot County's past and Talbot County's present. And so I've come around really slowly to this, and frankly, I did not fully embrace complete removal of this until pretty recently.
Pete Lesher co-sponsored the bill to take the statue down. It's not exactly a comfortable position for him, out on the front lines of something so controversial.
I'm not one generally to upset the apple cart. And so being the outspoken advocate for the complete removal of the Talbot boys, I will tell you, is not a terribly comfortable role for me that I find myself in. And certainly there are others who are more verbose and more articulate and more strident than I am on this issue.
The statue's most prominent defender on the council is Laura Price.
Removing the Talbot Boy statue might be a real issue in our community, or it might simply be an abrupt reaction to the chaos that is being fanned around the country.
She's protected the statue for years now. But then there are council members Chuck Callahan and Frank DeVilio. It was hard to know what they thought about the Talbot Boys.
Talbot County is so unique. We're going to be coming together, just like everybody's saying. And that's our whole goal. I think everybody's goal here tonight to talk through this is starting the conversation.
You may fight with one another, as we have. We will always disagree on many different things. But at the end of the day, we've come back, and we're still making huge leaps and bounds in diversity and dealing with and working together with race relations.
That brings us to County Council President Corey Pack.
So my early years in Talbot County, I knew nothing about the Talbot Boy statue.
Corey Pack isn't from Talbot County. He came here in 2002 to run a local parole office.
I walked past the statue numerous times, but never stopped to read the names that are inscribed on the base, never asked questions of the locals about the statue, and did not become, you know, aware of its history, of its beginnings, until after coming onto the council.
It's probably worth mentioning, Corey is the only Black member of the Talbot County Council. I don't mean the only one currently serving. I mean he's the only Black member ever.
So do you remember the first time someone brought it up, either to you personally or in public at one of the meetings, brought up, you know, well, let's get rid of the Confederate monument?
It had to be in around 2015. I'm trying to think when the incident in South Carolina.
He means the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, when a white supremacist killed 9 Black churchgoers. After Charleston, a lot of cities took down their Confederate monuments. New Orleans, Baltimore, even Birmingham got rid of theirs. So the Talbot County branch of the NAACP asked the county council to get rid of the Talbot Boys. Richard Potter is the president of that branch.
Our case was that the courthouse is a place where any constituent, regardless of race, color, gender, should be able to go and get a fair and just trial. And how can people of color think that they're going to get a fair and just trial when you have a monument that adorns the grounds of the courthouse that says to one group of people, you should have remained enslaved? And the council thanked us for the presentation and said that they would get back to us.
And I will say, Casey, if we had taken a poll in 2015 when the council first considered this, I would dare say that the vote probably would have been by Talbot County and Sioux to keep the statue in place.
Lynn Milkey, a retired attorney who practiced law in Easton, was one of the people defending the statue.
What's your first memory of the statue at the courthouse? Do you remember the first time you saw it or anyone mentioned it to you?
No. Just when this whole thing came about, it was, you know, 40 plus years of, or 35 years of practicing in that courthouse. And for a long time, it was hidden behind, you know, just overgrown trees, shrubs, or whatever. So, no.
Since 2015, Lynn has written a half dozen editorials and letters to the editor opposing removal. She's also given public comments at council meetings.
We have better and more important tasks to devote your time to and our time to and money and energy in order to achieve racial justice than to obsess over erasing our history and taking down this statue. The wave of hysteria has got to end. Not by erasing one side of history, but rather context.
I'm sure you're aware of the kind of assumptions a lot of listeners to this will bring to the kind of question of, okay, well, who's for these monuments? And I wonder, you know, if you had a direct line to those people, kind of what you would say about why you have become so active in the fight to preserve this one.
I'm just an advocate for preserving history and not tearing it down as a pulse of the moment. Like ISIS tore down statues in the Middle East.
Gotcha.
Even tearing down, you know, the Abraham Lincoln statue that Frederick Douglass commented on. It's a preservation of history, for better or for worse, that I'm an advocate for. History can be represented better, and the constituency of Talbot County determines that, then that's how it should be.
I guess my question is it just about, you know, not wanting to succumb to the mob and feeling like this is Talbot Countyans deciding? Or do you think the statue is objectively good and it should be there?
I know, I haven't thought that through. And I'm not going to answer something off the top of my head.
This is a monument that commemorates those deceased Talbot Countyans who fought and died in battle. Whether you agree or disagree with the cause that these young men fought for doesn't change the historical facts of the war.
In November 2015, the county council announced that the Talbot Boys statue would be staying right where it was. They read out their unanimous decision at one of their public meetings. The statement had been drafted by Corey Pack.
It would be a sign of dishonor to those 90 deceased soldiers, as well as disrespectful to the family members, should this council or any other council remove, deface, or alter this monument in any way. Therefore, this council does not support the recommendation to have the Talbot Boys monument moved to another location.
That's Corey Pack, the president of the Talbot County Council, speaking in 2015. Now, the vote that year to keep the Confederate monument on the courthouse lawn was unanimous. But this summer, in the midst of a national reckoning on race and racial justice, the town of Easton is again considering what to do about the Talbot Boys statue. We'll find out just what happened in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Staff writer Casey Sepp has been reporting on the effort to remove a Confederate statue in Easton, Maryland. She grew up near Easton and spoke with many of those involved in the decision, including the County Council President Corey Pack, who opposed removing the statue in 2015.
It was obviously, it seemed at the time strategic to have you be the council member. You know, the Black council member is the one who decided to preserve the monument. But did you think at the time, you know, the symbolism of this is, here I am, the only Black elected official, and I will be the one, you know, defending the Confederacy, as it were? Or did it just...
I can't say that I was completely divorced of that thought, because I wasn't. And I was trying to be as deliberate in my response as I possibly could, without factoring in race, without factoring in, well, am I supporting the Confederacy, or am I supporting slavery by, you know, saying that the statue should stay? And again, those conversations that I had with local citizens fed into that decision making, you know. And if I had heard from those baby boomers saying, hey, Corey, you know, it's horrible, take it down, we need to get rid of it, it probably would have colored my decision a great deal. But that was not what I was hearing.
I feel like there was already some talks about the Talbot Boy statue in our community after the death of George Floyd and after the protests were happening all over the world.
This is Tori Paxson. She's an activist in Talbot County. Paxson and a group of her friends helped organize a protest in Easton in June. I was there. I think it was probably the largest protest in the history of Talbot County. For a place that's the size of Easton, and for a town that's like the town of Easton, it's actually pretty incredible for that many people to gather for anything. I ran into some teachers of mine from high school and from elementary school. My sisters ran into people they work with. It was a pretty moving day and brought together a lot of people from the community.
I can't remember exactly how many people came. I think it was close to 1,000. And it was just amazing to see all of that come together, especially in a town that needs it so much, because race wasn't talked about for such a long time. And if it was talked about, it was disregarded.
See, for Tori Paxson, the statue isn't just a symbol of the past, the way Lynn Mielke and others describe it. For her, it's a symbol of the white supremacy she feels right now in her community.
I personally was racially profiled every time I was pulled over by the police. It was this constant aspect of, do you have drugs on you? And if you do have drugs on you, where are the drugs at? Don't get me wrong, I understand from some degree, being a white person in Talbot County and only going into white spaces in Talbot County, you probably wouldn't know about these things because you've never encountered them. But they do exist, and they happen a lot in Talbot County.
That was the realization that Council President Corey Pack was just coming to.
I have come to a point where there have been a change in me regarding signs and symbols and what they mean. They do carry an immense weight. I think the voice of the millennials have been the carrying wave of a lot of these changes of opinion of middle-aged men like myself who are sitting in seats of local power. I really do. I mean, the baby boomers that I spoke with back in 2015, quite honestly, Casey, they could care less about the statue. But for the voice of the millennial, I don't think you would have this movement that you're having today.
Is there, I mean, are we to gather there's a millennial in your life who's kind of, you know, changed your mind?
I do have a millennial in my life. You know, I do have a 25-year-old daughter who has been very active as of late.
Corey Pack's daughter is Tori Paxson, the activist.
I feel like when it comes to my father and I feel like we've always kind of sort of battled sometimes. But I think once I talk to him more about my own experiences and also about the experiences of my friends, you know, kids that he watched me grow up with. And I think that's what really resonated with him and made this change happen.
And let me say this. I've gone back and talked to some of those people I talked with 5 years ago. They said, hey, look, it's not going to add an extra day to my life, an extra inch to my height. But Corey, now is the time. We got to do this now. It's time.
In June, a resolution was presented to the county council to remove the Talbot boys from the courthouse lawn. It had two sponsors, Pete Lesher and Corey Pack.
Resolution prohibiting statues depicting persons, signs, or symbols associated with military action on Talbot County property and providing for the removal of the Talbot boys statue while retaining the base of the monument.
The council got a lot of public comment. At their meetings, over the phone, by email, even in the pages of the local newspaper, there was a huge surge in support for getting rid of the Talbot boys. According to the county's official record, they heard from almost 900 people about the Talbot boys. And by my count, more than 700 of them were calling for removal.
Recognized by no government on earth, the insurgency that fought our country does not deserve to be memorialized on public grounds.
But I want to express strong support for the removal of the entire structure, the entire statue representing the Talbot boys. Let's not kick this down the road. Let's get it done. For all of us.
Richard Potter of the NAACP has always been optimistic about getting rid of the statue.
Right will always prevail. And if you don't do what's right, right has a way of continuing to resurface. And will you take the opportunity to do what's right this time around?
Resolution 290. Madam Secretary, would you please read the title of the resolution?
Resolution number 290, a resolution prohibiting statues depicting persons.
Which brings us to the night of the big vote, Tuesday, August 11th.
Because we have had no public input on amendments 2 or 3, I believe that that is inappropriate for us to take any votes on the amendments this evening.
That's Laura Price. She and Chuck Callahan made the kind of unbelievable argument that more public comment was needed before they could do anything.
There's a lot of people out there that really would love to probably just hearing these for the first time. And we don't know that. So we need to give them the right to think it through to see if that's right for them. So
it's honestly impossible to believe that the council has ever heard from more people about anything. Councilman Pack, at least, seemed as mystified by this line of objection as I was watching the meeting at home.
I'm just saying, if that's the way you feel, Mr. Callahan, then
right.
That's nothing wrong if that's the way you feel. All I was alluding to is that in the past, you have said that
I've said that many times.
I've said
that many times.
Well, what's the argument? That's all I said.
But the argument is, this is something that's 155 years old.
It's not 155 years old. It was erected in 1916.
We're talking history.
We're talking history here.
That's what we're talking.
Yes, but the statue is not 150 years old.
It's 106. It's 106. It's older than us. That's for sure. And nobody's here that's on that statue. There's 84 names on that statue, and they can't stand in front of us and tell us what their thoughts are. So that's something you need to think about, too.
Here was a council member saying that it was more important to him to consider the opinions of Confederate ghosts than it was to consider the opinions of his living, breathing constituents.
I'd like to push it down the road a little bit so that people can put their thoughts together. Do they like these?
That made Frank DeVilio the swing vote. Finally, he said what he was thinking.
My problems with the amendments is the timing of right now with COVID-19, I'm absolutely committed to this goal, and I'm committed to being fair and transparent. This piece of legislation has been brought in front of the public at a time when we've not been able to open up to the public as we have in the past. Now it's time for us to put it back to the community. If they've asked 3 different councils to change their opinion, and we've tried, we're putting it back to the community to put it on a ballot question would be my plan, so that everybody has that opportunity to voice their opinion.
Look, there's a lot to say about that. First of all, it's not clear that the State Board of Elections would even allow a public opinion poll like that on a ballot ever. But even if they did, the earliest that that question could appear on a ballot is 2022, which would mean that the council members would get to run for re-election without ever dealing with the monument.
I don't want to belabor this point. I don't want to belabor the public and the media any further with this. I think at this point, let's go ahead and call the roll and move on. Madam Secretary, please call your roll on Resolution 290 as drafted.
Mr. Pack?
Aye.
Mr. DeVilio?
No.
Mr. Callahan?
No.
Mr. Lesher?
Aye.
Ms. Price?
No.
Resolution 290 fails.
I called Richard Potter right after the vote.
Was it fair in the beginning when we first started out and we went through this process? And then now at the end you want to say that it's not fair because it did not give your constituents, which are the racist white people of Talbot County, an opportunity to speak out?
Richard was in his car on his way to a protest outside the courthouse. I was on my way there, too.
No peace! No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace!
By the time I got there, there were already about 100 people at the courthouse. They'd come from Easton, of course, but also from Unionville and Trapp and St. Michael's and Oxford, all these little towns like the one that I grew up in. There were people who came with signs saying, "Vote them out," and "No hate in our state," things they'd just thrown together really quickly and gone because they didn't know what else to do.
Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter! Black lives matter!
Those protesters were loud enough that you could hear them inside the council chamber.
We understand that citizens are quite upset over the earlier vote taken today, so council is going to go ahead and suspend the balance of this meeting. We're at the end of the meeting. I know there's been a number of people.
Council members Laura Price and Chuck Callahan never responded to requests to be interviewed for this piece. Councilman DeVilio commented by email. He wrote, "I have been treated horribly by people I've known my entire life after that vote. I've decided to move forward with my own plan and not allow any of them to help." On the night of August 11th, he exited the courthouse to a wall of protesters chanting shame.
Shame, 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 shame.
But when Corey and Pete left the courthouse, they were greeted like heroes.
I talked to many before about how I truly was hopeful. And I'm so sorry that I disappointed you.
No,
I'm really sorry.
My Lord,
we will not give up.
It's hard to look at the statue debate and not think that something went wrong. It might be tempting to say something like, "Well, that's local government, bureaucratic, slow to act." But I really don't think that's what happened here. The Talbot Boys statue remains for the exact same reason it was put up, not because it's historically accurate or because it reflects the shared values of the community, but because powerful people wanted it there, and it's within their power to ignore the people who don't. Fewer and fewer people in Talbot County will come right out and say that they support honoring the Confederacy or that the Civil War wasn't really about slavery. Mostly what you'll hear them say now is, "We can't give in to mob rule," or, "That statue's our history, and we can't destroy it." Above all, what they like to say is, "We can't take any action right now." But leaving the monument is an action. It's a vote to honor those who fought to maintain slavery in America. 5 years ago, all five council members cast that kind of vote. Last month, only three did. Someday, none will. Time is finally catching up with the Talbot Boys. And I know soon there will be no more Confederate monuments in the public squares of Maryland or anywhere else in America.
Casey Sepp, You can find her reporting on the Talbot Boy statue at newyorker.com. She's also the author of Furious Hours, a book about a murder trial and the late work of Harper Lee. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. With just a few exceptions, I don't think there's anything in classical music that's more familiar than Richard Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries from his opera, The Valkyrie. That theme has appeared in movies as various as Birth of a Nation and Apocalypse Now, and even a Bugs Bunny cartoon. And you may not have even realized that this was from Wagner, too. The New Yorker's music critic Alex Ross has written some amazing books about modern music, starting with The Rest is Noise, and his new book is called Wagnerism. It's about the long shadow that the composer cast not just in music, but over much of the culture of the 20th century. Alex's book opens just as Wagner dies, and he quotes from the obituaries, which were effusive, to say the least.
1883. Deceased yesterday in our city was the musical genius of Germany. Ricardo Wagner is dead. How many memories crowd upon our mind? The bold struggles that he sustained, the sublime victories that he achieved, the art that he created, the bitter enemies he had, the fanatical partisans that idolized him as a god, the crowned kings who knelt down before him. No more, a corpse. But from him rises a voice that will not die, and perhaps will become in time more powerful, more hearkened to, more beloved.
He was a man of the theater, loved the stage, loved the flamboyance and the aliveness of the stage, and everything emanated from that. The music, the text, the planning, directing the stage, it all comes back to putting on a show.
Well, your book is not a biography, strictly speaking, of Wagner. It's called Wagnerism. And the idea is that more than anyone in what we might call classical music, more than Bach, more than Beethoven or Mozart, Wagner has been a colossal influence on all of culture. How can you even begin to sketch the range of his influence?
He had a huge influence on music, not necessarily more so than Monteverdi or Bach or Beethoven. And the question of his influence on music was something that I just completely put aside in this book, because that's a book or many books in itself. But in terms of how he affected artists and writers, architects, dancers, choreographers, theater theorists, intellectuals, philosophers, it was enormous. And by the turn of the last century, this fabulous decadent period of the fin de siècle, if you were a young artist or really kind of any cultured young person at that time, you had to have some relationship with Wagner. You could worship him, you could reject him, you could do whatever else you wanted with him, but you had to have a stance.
There was in some hearers real antipathy to the composer, in others animosity to him as a German, and these prejudices struggled fiercely against the dominating power of the music and the rapturous enthusiasm of the majority.
If you grew up in the 60s, you sort of had to have some relationship with the Beatles or Bob Dylan. It was just absolutely universal.
So Wagner was a horrendous anti-Semite. Why hasn't he been, I hate to use the phrase, canceled? For those beliefs.
Well, people have been trying to cancel Wagner since the 1850s without success. He was incredibly controversial from the start, and his anti-Semitism became a point of contention very early on. It's very complicated. It's actually somewhat difficult to pin him down on this question, which it seems like one of the very simple, straightforward things about him. He was anti-Semitic. He had profound problems with Jewish people, and he said so at nauseating length. But in terms of his influence on those who came after him, on the nationalists and the anti-Semites, and eventually Hitler, there are some gaps. So Wagner certainly played a role in popularizing anti-Semitism, but in terms of how he affected the rest of the development of German politics, that's a much tougher question, and there's still a lot of debate over that.
So when we think of Wagner as the theme music of the fascism to come, how mistaken is that?
It is partly mistaken. You know, the thing with Wagner is that there's a temptation to paint the devil's horns on him and sort of make him out to be the bogeyman. And there are definitely problems with that view. I think to some extent it lets everyone else off the hook. There were many other forces that went into the roots of Nazi ideology.
But you can imagine that some people would find these distinctions, maybe a distinctions without a difference. When you would see audiences all over the world, particularly in New York and in Israel and other places, objecting to the performance of Wagner's music on this basis, how do you react?
I'm not going to argue with anyone who finds Wagner reprehensible and doesn't want to listen to him. It's not the purpose of this book to kind of seduce people into listening to Wagner. But I do think we can get carried away with this demonization of Wagner and sort of giving him an outsized role. You know, there are other sides of Wagner that pointed in a very different political direction. I think this is what is so often forgotten is Wagner's influence on the left, on social democrats in Germany and Austria and other countries, on communists. He was a figure of some importance in early Bolshevik Russia as a kind of hero of the proletarian theater. He influenced and excited feminists and early gay rights activists. W.E.B. Du Bois was an enormous fan of Wagner, and there were several other African Americans of the late 19th century, early 20th century, who loved Wagner.
Forgive me, but why in particular did he appeal to Du Bois and various African American artists and political figures?
Du Bois saw this exploitation of a mythic past for modern ends as a model, actually, for African-American artists. He thought, well, our artists can do the same thing in sort of reaching back to myth and making these old stories come alive.
1936. It is as though some one of us chose out of the wealth of African folklore a body of poetic material and with music, scene, and action, retold for mankind the suffering and triumphs and defeats of a people.
He might have seen Black Panther, the film, as a kind of Wagnerian enterprise, because you know that is exactly what that film is doing. And it's a sign that that happens over and over again with these people of very different backgrounds. Something happens when they listen to Wagner and they get these, what I call, glimpses of future greatness, of sort of future possibility.
You write about something called the Wagner spell, which is essentially the way his music captivated listeners of his day. What was so enchanting about Wagner? What was the transcendent quality there, and when is it captured in modern times?
Wagner's way with the orchestra was astounding, and he had a way of creating a kind of orchestral soundscape where the fact that you were listening to music, the fact that you were watching instrumentalists produce sound seemed to kind of disappear, and the sort of the sound was kind of emanating out of the walls. And one of my favorite moments is at the beginning of Parsifal, where there's this shimmer of sound and arpeggios and the strings and murmuring winds, and then this solo line, which is a trumpet and oboes.
This sounds so uncannily familiar, and not just from listening to it on a recording, but from it's as if you've been in more than one film and heard this music quoted in some way or another, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely. You've heard the Prelude of Parsifal in Terrence Malick's films and Werner Herzog, sort of going back to the early days of silent film. People were reaching toward Wagner because of that spell, and also because of the use of leitmotifs, these sort of identifying tags for different characters and different situations. It was a great crutch in early film history. If horses are galloping across the screen, have the movie house pianist play The Ride of the Valkyries, you know. And so Wagner was part of the vocabulary of Hollywood from the very beginning, and was...
Well, with Ride of the Valkyries, you hear it in this terrifying scene in Birth of a Nation. Why do you suppose the filmmakers scored that with Wagner?
Right. It was terribly ominous that you have the Ride of the Valkyries playing with the triumphant ride of the Ku Klux Klan at the climax of this horrendously racist movie, which was so enormously popular in its day and was really one of the founding documents of Hollywood cinema. So why Wagner in that scene? My feeling is probably that this was just already part of the common practice to have the Ride of the Valkyries playing with horse scenes, and the Ku Klux Klan were there on their horses. So there may not have been a kind of, you know, grand design behind it. But for what jumped out to me is that in the late 19th century, people loved this music. It was hugely popular, but it tended not to be associated with this kind of military scene. You know, the Ride of the Valkyries is about these powerful women sailing through the air on their horses. And it was actually sometimes associated specifically with a kind of feminist message. Some feminist writers found the spectacle of Wagner's Valkyries inspiring. And then Hollywood comes along and makes the Ride of the Valkyries male action music. And that's an interesting shift, and I think it has a lot more to do with Hollywood than with Wagner.
Alex, you've now finished a long process, years and years of immersion in Wagner and all the culture that comes out of Wagner. And part of what comes with Wagner is the sheer volume of it, the length of it, the what we call Sitzfleisch, the number of hours sitting down listening to a single opera or performance. Will you happily go back to the opera house and listen to another 4, 5, 6 hour long opera, or are you Wagnered out?
I'm not, actually. People have asked me that, and I haven't gotten sick of him. The whole process of the book was an incredibly rich experience for me. I mean, I spent some time, much time, listening to the music itself, but much more it was about immersing myself in this vast body of literature and art that was in some way or another affected by Wagner. It was an incredibly rich experience. And I think with a figure like Wagner, who so much baggage arrives with him, we aren't necessarily imprisoned by what the man himself thought. We aren't forced to experience Wagner the way he might have wanted us to, or the way people experienced him in the past. You know, we are free to make him our own, and this applies to every kind of art, I think. And we can just place it in a completely new context and find a new understanding for it. And that ultimately is what this book is about. Wagner, in a curious way, starts to disappear as this book goes on. He sort of transforms into other people. He becomes a mirror for what other people are thinking and feeling. And we have that right. I think we have that power with art. If there's something about it we reject, we can, without forgetting, without overlooking that darker aspect, we can remake it in our own image and put it to new use.
My friend and colleague Alex Ross, thank you.
Be quiet, I'm hunting rabbits.
The book is Wagnerism. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's extraordinary.
Kill the rabbit, kill the rabbit.
I'm David Remnick, and thanks for listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour this week.
Kill the rabbit.
And I hope you'll join us next time.
Yo ho, yo ho, yo ho, yo ho, yo ho.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Lea, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Morgan Flannery, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
We had assistance this week from Aaron Henkin of WYPR in Baltimore and Isaac Jones.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.